study it in form, and from a superficial standpoint, or from there. Deep voice of your inner souls. Hear it. Study it down below the surface. Probe it clear to the bottom, if possible. See that he did not descend into valleys of human misery, and rise again uninterruptedly to the Mount of Transfiguration. You make a very great mistake in supposing that progression implies one constant, uninterrupted march onward. Question. Is man anything more or less than the creature of birth and circumstances? If he is born with strong moral and mental characteristics, and the circumstances in which he is placed are congenial, he lives, as a matter of course, a moral and intellectual life. If, on the other hand, he is born with mental and moral qualities but moderately strong, and his surroundings are strongly adverse, he leads a depraved life. Now, taking this view of the subject, can man be considered a responsible being, or responsible in that manner and to that extent which the world, or a certain portion of it, considers him to be? Answer. The poet says, 'Tis education forms the common mind, just as the twig is bent the tree's inclined. And the poet tells here a great truth. Education does almost everything towards fashioning your human lives, towards determining concerning the course you shall take in all the various avenues of this life. If you are educated to consider this path the best, you will be very likely to take it. If you are educated to consider the opposite best, you will very naturally take it. Your human nature is molded in this life by your education. But there is a divine judge placed in every reasoning individual that will call the individual to account for all deeds and all thoughts, and to that judge you are responsible, and to none outside of that. No one is there outside of that divine judge which belongs to you as an individual to call you to judgment. You may infringe upon the rights of another, but the judge within will call you to account. Be sure of that, if you have in reality infringed upon another's rights. You can make no mistake in this life that you will not be punished for, that you will not be held accountable for by the divine judge which belongs to you as an individual. Question. You do not mean to say that this punishment falls at once upon the trespasser. Answer. I mean to say that just as soon as you in your external nature come into rapport with the voice of the inner judge, you must respond, and you must come to judgment. It cannot be otherwise, and your sentence is quick and sure. By Theodore Parker, July 1, 1869. Question. Should the prayer be addressed directly to our departed friends, or to some other power or principle that may be enabled to assist? Answer. It matters not whether you make an agent of the spirit you desire to commune with, or whether you pray to the great general spirit, that which is within each one of us. It makes no difference. Question. Is there any such thing as a special providence that directs all the acts of life, to whom we can pray to ask for particular blessings? Answer. All the special providence that I know of is general law, such as pertains to general life. I do not know, indeed, I do not believe that we can change the law one jot or tittle by our prayers. We can place ourselves in harmony with our circumstances, with the conditions by which we are divinely and humanly surrounded, by prayer, which is all, in my opinion, that we can do. We might pray to all eternity for the sun to come down that we may examine it. Would it come? I think not. We may pray to all eternity that Mount Vesuvius may be removed and cast into the sea. Answer. It will not avail. I know the record says so, but I do not believe it. Prayer, in that case, without works, would fail, but we could go to work with shovel and spade, and perhaps do very much towards it. Prayer makes us in harmony with the law. It fits us to receive what we ask for, but it does by no means change the law itself. Question. Was Christ a spiritualist? Answer. Yes, he was a spiritualist in the largest sense, and he lives today in your spiritual movement just as much as he lived in the spiritual movement of his day. By Cardinal Chevreuse. July 6, 1869. Question. We find recorded in heathen mythology the history of a prophet almost identical in name and acts with Jesus, his name Krishna, or Krishma, and the circumstance of women wiping his feet with their hair is such a remarkable coincidence, that while it shakes the faith of the Christian, it furnishes strong proof to the skeptic of the mythical character of Christ. Can you give us light on the subject? Answer. Every nation has its idols, its gods and goddesses, peculiar shrines whereunto the people are called to worship. Neither Krishna, nor Christ, were entirely beings of mythology, but so far as a certain portion of their lives are concerned, there is much of the mythic attached to them, and this is the case with all those beings that the nations worship. The aborigines of the country have their divinities, whose original is in real life, but that original is surrounded with so many mythical figures that the real is almost entirely lost to the human sight. While contemplating the mythic Christ, we are very apt to overlook the real personality, the spirit. We are very apt to see only the external paraphernalia that the real has been surrounded with. It is not at all strange. It is in accordance with our organization as human beings. We are growing up through a variety of conditions that determine for us whether we will or no. These conditions determine concerning our religious worship, concerning our God even. It is these conditions that form the image of our God, and determine that we shall worship that God, and none other. And as intelligence marches on through the ages, as mind becomes more and more enlightened with regard to the history of past nations, and past religious histories, those images that have been invested with divinity begin to assume different shapes, begin to stand out in their real characters, begin to be seen for what they are. We understand them better as the light is shed upon them, the divine light, that which emanates from the past which comes to us from the present, and that which is shed to us from the future. All things conspire to aid the spirit in its search for truth, all kinds of truth. The knowledge that such an individual as Krishna lived, does not at all detract from the reality or divinity of the Christian's Christ. But it only shows, or should show, the Christian that one of the fundamentals of the Christian Church has been borrowed from ancient mythology. The Christ may be himself pure and intact. The truth is there, but the clothing has been borrowed. The rite of baptism is a borrowed rite. In fact, all the rites of the Christian Church, every one of them, are borrowed, some from Krishna, some from Vishnu. In fact, all the gods that preceded the Christian God have loaned of their wardrobe, and the Christians have appropriated it that their Christ may be clothed. The present age offers great light, and whosoever refuses to see by it, and learn of it, will refuse to eat that bread which cometh down from heaven, which will nourish the soul for eternity. By Abdul Hadi A., July 12, 1869. Question. Is there an element of life distinct from life germs? Answer. Life and form are one and inseparable. Spirit and matter ever act in concert. They are never separated. When you talk about spirit as divorced from matter, you enter a wide field of speculation, that will always be a field of speculation, and nothing more. Spirit and matter are one and inseparable. You can no more separate them than you can separate God from his works. Can you do this? I have never found the individual who could. I have seen very many who have attempted it, and who have worked very hard to do it, but I never saw one that was successful. Spirit and matter belong together, and we can only know of spirit or life as we know of matter. There is a subtle ether pervading space, entering all bodies, and assisting in all manifestations of life, but as subtle as that is, it is connected with matter. The unseen forces pervading all nature are connected with matter. We only know what the air is by the matter it is connected with. We can never know anything of life only as we know it through forms of matter. We only read the scriptures of our God through matter. I am a materialist, in every sense, because I know from observation and earnest study in the spirit world that matter and spirit always go together, and are never separate. Question. What becomes of the life, the sensation, the instinct, the knowledge existing in the animal creation below man at their death? Answer. All the instincts or reasons that belong to all the species of life below man and up to man are constantly changing places. The lower takes the qualities of the higher, passes through the higher, and goes on, forever on, changing its form and characteristics, but preserving its life intact. Nothing is lost, but everything is subject to the law of change. You are not to suppose that these human forms are precisely like those that the spirit manifests through after death. They are crowned with new attributes there, although they retain all that ever belonged to them. They are constantly gathering fresh ones, constantly changing place and changing form. The animal does not lose its identity at death, by any means, it is an animal still. It comes through death to a higher plane, and there waits for another change. When that comes, it takes a higher stand. It passes ever onward and upward, but it does not lose its identity. The horse is the horse still. The dog is the dog still, and yet you know that all species of life, whether animal, vegetable, or mineral, are capable of improvement. You can improve them by your intelligence here, and if this is true, do you not suppose they go on improving to all eternity? The dog is a finer dog in the spirit world than here. The horse is a finer horse, the tree is a more glorious tree, the flower is far more beautiful than here. And yet they preserve all that belongs to them, but they take on new life at every change. Question. The Christian world do not admit the tree nor the flower into the spirit world. Answer. Oh, no, of course not. The Christian world, as you well know, doubtless, has made a great many mistakes. Christianity has always bowed down to error, and to nothing else. Christianity has overlooked the real life, and bowed down to idols always. In my time I had not the slightest faith or sympathy with your Christianity, not that which is embodied in creeds or churches, not at all. I had faith in all that was good. I believed in the principle of goodness, in the one God superintending all things and guiding all according to his own will. But I had not the slightest faith in the soundness and genuineness or truthfulness of your Bible, your creeds, or your churches. They were to me false lights, leading us into ditches and pitfalls and miry places. Question. We classify all existences into the ponderable and imponderable. Your existence is to us that of the imponderable. Can you take cognizance of the elements we term imponderable as plainly and palpably as we can that of the ponderable? Answer. That which you cannot feel, or recognize with all of your human senses, is imponderable to you. The air is an imponderable substance, for it is a substance. To us the air contains images, forms of substance as tangible, as real as the solid earth to you. We take cognizance more clearly of those conditions of life that are imponderables to you than you do, because we have passed into nearer rapport with them. We stand face to face with them. But there are subtle elements in advance of us. There are elements still imponderable to us. Advance as far in life as we may, we shall still find an element that is imponderable to us. We approach. 1. We come into rapport with it. We analyze it, we find out what it is, and having disposed of that, lo! There is another presented. Our Father, God, does not mean that we shall be idle, that there shall ever come a time to our souls when we can say we have learned the whole, there is nothing more for us to learn or to do. God is wise. He knows that our spirits need to be active, and He gives us just one lesson at a time, and no more. Question. Is there any truth in astrology? Answer. Yes, the basis of astrology is eminently true. There are many features presented by astrology, modern and ancient, that are not true. But in the main the science is eminently true. We know that every form is connected with all other forms. There is a reciprocity of action throughout all nature. The planets act upon us, and we upon them. They determine concerning certain characteristics of our being, and they, possessing the larger life and larger power over us, of course guide us to a very great extent. We cannot guide the planets, because we are inferior to them, but the planets can guide us, can determine concerning our physical lives, to a very great extent. The science of astrology, when considered from a spiritual standpoint, is sublime. It presents wonders to our spirits that no other science ever has. It holds within itself the glory of the past, the present, and the future, and it beckons us onward as no other science ever has, or, in my opinion, ever can. By William E. Channing, July 13, 1869. Question. Do not the teachings at these seances tend to educate us to reject a belief of the spiritual superiority of Jesus over all other men living, or who have lived? Speaking for myself, as a lover of Jesus, I know I have great consolation in that love, and would very much dislike to have it lessened. Even accepting that your teachings are true, does not my special love for Jesus result beneficially to myself and to my daily life, by bringing me more en rapport with the principles of which he was the embodiment? Take from us our love of and belief in Jesus, and even the best of us have nothing left but general moral sentiments. But leave Jesus to us, and we have friend, counselor and example, in a word, God incarnate. I do not ask, of course not, that truth be sacrificed to expediency, but cannot we justly believe that Jesus was more than man, and more than any man has been, or ever can be? Take your own teachings of what God is, cannot we safely believe that Jesus was more of this than men were or are? If this, to my view very important, string of queries be replied to, can the reply include some special reference to myself that shall convince me that it came from me over the river? Answer. If spiritualism teaches any investigating soul to think less of the pure doctrines of Jesus of Nazareth, then such a soul had better abandon the investigation of spiritualism. Spiritualism is but the voice of this same Jesus the Christ, speaking unto the people of this day, but how few there are who recognize this voice. Even those who pretend to know most about Jesus know the least generally. Your correspondent, Mr. Chairman, seems to be wedded to an idol. He seems to have more love for the personality of Jesus than for the divine principles he taught. He seems to forget that there is a divine truth in spiritualism, precisely analogous to that which was taught by Jesus. Christianity has ever tended to idolatry, and I suppose it ever will, because Christianity has bowed down before the form, and has not thought of worshipping the spirit that animated the form. Christianity has recognized only the form. It is to be deplored, but it is true. Your correspondent says he is a lover of Christ. It is well, but he had better be in love with the divine principles of truth that this man Jesus taught, than to be in love with the man, for he is nothing more than man, human, fallible, like ourselves. Behold him in his agony in the garden, praying that the cup might pass from him. If he were God, would he have thus prayed? Surely not. Again, behold him upon the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. If he had the power to forgive, would he have thus prayed? If he was God in the flesh, as a specialty, would he have thus petitioned the Father to forgive his enemies? No, surely not. All our reason rebels against that I'd answer. He was our elder brother, preeminent in virtue, in all those glorious principles that shine so bright through every age, in the midst of all kinds of darkness. But there have been others than Jesus through whom these lights have shone. Every nation has been blessed with its divine teachers. Every tribe of men has been blessed with its prophets, its seers, its wise men and holy women, and shall we say that none of them were divinely inspired but Jesus? It would be hardly fair to so determine. I would that there were more devout worshippers at the shrine of the Spirit of Christ, and less at the shrine of the personality. I would that men and women could worship more the divine principle, and less the image. But so it is. The crust of humanity at present is not thin enough for the spirit to look out and behold beyond the form of the spirit that animates the form. But since we are growing through the conditions of life, passing higher and still higher, we have a hope that the time will come when religion, pure and undefiled, will be known, that religion that worships God in spirit and in truth, that knows no form, that recognizes no altar save those the living God has erected everywhere, that expects no general judgment, but knows that the judgment seat is within every living soul. Your correspondent has but to compare notes between modern spiritualism and that Judean spiritualism taught by Jesus, and he can but come to the conclusion, if he is a reasonable individual, that they are one and the same, and that if he worships the Spirit of Christ as exhibited upon the plains of Judea, he worships the spirit of spiritualism as it is seen today. Question. Do spirits regard the misdeeds of their earth friends in the same light they did while here in the physical form? Answer. Oh, no. They regard them with sympathy, with charity, with pity, they regard them in the full light of truth, they are able to see behind the effect, and discern the cause, they know wherefore their friends take this or that course in life, they see the propelling forces, the levers that move their friends in this or that direction. And when they see them forced by circumstances to take that which is the lesser good, they mourn over the course they have taken, but not without hope, because they know that by the experience they will gain in traveling that way, they will attain strength to free themselves, and will avoid such a course in future by coming into harmony with better laws, by making themselves acquainted with their surroundings. When we are thoroughly acquainted with the laws that govern us, we shall, of course, place ourselves in harmony with those laws, and shall move on in concert with them. It is only because we are ignorant of ourselves and the law, and our relation to the law, that we kick so hard against law. If we were not ignorant, we should never do this, because we should know that the law is greater than ourselves, and would rend us more severely if we were not in harmony with it. Question. Is there such a thing as that which we have been accustomed to term the vital principle or vital force, or is it a mere mode by which the elementary principles of life act? Answer. Yes, there is such a thing as a vital force, a subtle principle that not only pervades the human form and keeps it in motion, but pervades all other forms. You call it sometimes electricity, sometimes magnetism. You divide it off into different degrees or states, and give it different names. It is an imponderable essence, that keeps these human machines in motion by playing upon the nerves, and the nerves in turn play upon the muscles. If it was not for the presence of this vital force in the system, decay would ensue. Wherever it is absent, decomposition begins to take place. If any part of the system is diseased, the vital force is not there. If it was, it would ward off disease, it would keep the parts in health. The absence of it lays us open to disease. The presence of it keeps off disease, and keeps us in harmony with nature's laws. When the vital force is lacking in a plant, it dies. Its leaves wither, its stalk becomes unable to transmit anything that will give new life from the roots. So it is with all kinds of animal life. When the vital force is lacking, the animal form begins to change, to decompose. The particles begin to separate. This vital force is found in the atmosphere, in the water, in the lightning, in the darkness. You find it everywhere. We may as well call it God as to call it anything else. This was at page 318. By Theodore Parker, July 15, 1869. Question. Can there be such a thing as a new and original idea? Answer. No, not absolutely, because we do not know how much of the idea that we think we originate belongs really to us. We cannot tell how far we are inspired by circumstances. We are never able to determine whether our thoughts are absolutely our own, the productions of our own being, or infused into our minds by some outside source. Question. According to geological theory, there was a time when the matter composing our earth existed in a state of liquid fire, now, If the organizing life germs of all things are eternal as individualized entities, where, at that time, were the life germs that in the far distant future were to clothe the earth with vegetation, and people it with animal life? Answer. We may say, and truthfully, too, that the germs of all physical life, so far as planet life is concerned, are contained within the primary elements. Fire constitutes the basis of this planet, and all others. An eminent French chemist once said, that, to him, it was a fact that the flame produced from any body that was in process of burning contained within itself the entire body, and more than that, if it was of a vegetable or mineral nature, the germ of that vegetable or mineral form. The flame held that germ intact, and a form representing the external form or thing that was burning. We know from positive knowledge, from observation, that if we burn a rose upon the surface of the water, a microscope will reveal the shape of the rose intact upon the water, provided the water is still. I believe that not only the inner 319 life, but the outer form, possesses, to a high degree, immortality. I believe that nature holds in memory and in her vast laboratory all the forms that have ever been, preserves them all, loses not a single one. Question. Many persons believe that vegetation does sometimes spring from the earth under conditions which preclude the possibility that any seed with a material covering could have been there. Do you consider such a thing possible? Answer. Yes, I do. By Theodore Parker, July 19, 1869. Question. Is the veil separating the spiritual and material worlds as much an obstacle to spirits as to mortals? Answer. Yes, it is precisely the same, no difference. Question. Mortals penetrate this veil by clairvoyance, or the quickening of the spiritual senses, but how are spirits cognizant of earth scenes? Is it through their spiritual senses, or the corporeal senses of the medium? Answer. It is done by materializing the spiritual senses. This process is performed by coming into material rapport with certain mediumistic bodies, bodies that are constantly throwing off through their magnetic and electric lives the aura that can be used by spirits. They make use of it to see, to hear, to feel, to come into rapport with all the objects that belong to this life. Question. Please give the mode of birth into spirit life. Is the newly born spirit a spontaneous presence to his spirit friends, or is it a gradual process? Answer. When the last particle of magnetic life has been separated from the animal body, then the spirit body is thoroughly and well formed. It is a distinct, objective intelligence to all other spirits. Question. Do you, as a spirit, possess a more definite idea of your destiny, and the destiny of the human race, than you possessed while in the earth form? Answer. Yes, more definite, but not absolutely definite. We see a little farther into the future than we did when here, that is all. Question. What is the use of feet and legs to the spirit, whose locomotion is accompanied by and with the rapidity of the will? Answer. There is a use for all the limbs, all the parts and portions of the spirit body. The rose possesses beauty of color and form. It is not conscious that it does possess that beauty. It is all unconscious of the homage paid it by admiring mortals. Nevertheless, it possesses the beauty. Its petals are delicately formed and delicately painted. The spirit has need of form through which to express itself. The life of the rose, the spirit of the rose, has need of the form through which to express itself. It is a mistaken idea that spirits do not use their limbs in the spirit world. They do. They walk, they plan, they build, they have use for brains, for hands, for all the organs of the body, and as fast as the body has need of new unfoldment in form it has that new unfoldment. It does not remain always precisely what it was. If it did, it would not grow. The infant spirit, as it passes into mature intellectual life, has need of a more mature form. Every peculiar atom of life generates within itself a peculiar kind of electric and magnetic being,